Welcome everybody to the Sunday Roast, and we have a very special guest with us this week, Richard. Richard, could you introduce yourself to everyone, please?
Yeah, my name's Richard Corbett. I used to be a member of the European Parliament representing Yorkshire, and I was the UK Labour Party's last leader in the European Parliament in the run-up to Brexit. Brexit, which I think, by the way, was a dreadful mistake, but no doubt we'll be coming back to that later.
So I'm Big Match Studios. I run the Big Match Studios YouTube channel. And I'm also the co-host of this channel, the Sunday Roast podcast.
And yes, I'm Alex. I'm a YouTuber, I'm a historian, author, and political lecturer. And we're going to be talking today about Moldova. Congratulations, Moldova. You got past all the Russian interference, which is far more I can say than the UK have managed in its past. Richard, what are your thoughts on Moldova joining the EU?
Well, this is only a first step, of course. They've put it in their constitution that the government is mandated to apply to join and go through the hoops. The referendum was closer than expected, but as you rightly said, that's in the face of a lot of interference, not just sort of online and under the radar that we saw perhaps from time to time in Britain and elsewhere, but overtly in public with cash being given to voters to vote a certain way, quite brazen. And it was very close. In a sense, what tipped the balance was, as they were counting, was when the expat vote came in. Moldovans who live abroad, notably elsewhere across Europe, they tipped the balance. And I can't help thinking that if in Britain's referendum on Brexit back in 2016, remember, most Brits living abroad, like elsewhere in the EU, were not able to vote in that referendum, although they were directly affected. That might have made a difference. It might not, but there's a good chance it would have.
Some of the figures I saw was about 700,000 Brits in Europe were unable to vote, which is... That's just Europe. I mean... That's just Europe. I keep bringing up Anguilla. Caribbean island next to St. Martin's that has an EU border, and they had no say, they had no right to vote, which is just incredible when you think about it.
And nor did EU citizens living in Britain, also directly affected. On the other hand, Commonwealth citizens living in Britain, even if they were from Rwanda, which had only just joined the Commonwealth a few years before, they were entitled to vote in that referendum, which is a little bit inconsistent, shall we say.
We wouldn't want to describe the Brexit referendum as an inconsistent vote, would we?
Well, the rules were a bit odd in that respect. The other feature of it, of course, was that what was sold to us as the sunlit uplands, what Brexit was promised to be, well, reality bears no resemblance to that. You know, they said it would be easy. Turned out to be rather complicated. They said it would save lots of money that would all go to the NHS. In fact, it's cost a fortune. We've lost up to 5% of GDP from where it would otherwise be, according to the OBR. That translates into £40 billion of tax revenue every year. You know, just at the moment, we're looking at the Chancellor scraping around to try and find £3 billion extra here, £2 billion extra there. Well, £40 billion extra every year has been foregone because of Brexit. So Brexit has turned out to be very, very different from what was promised. And I think that's one of the reasons why the underlying trend in public opinion now shows well over 60% saying Brexit was a mistake.
It was interesting to see on France 24, who were following what was taking place in Moldova, say that the people and the politicians they were speaking to inside the EU were saying that Britain, if they wanted to rejoin, would require a higher level of percentage of the population showing interest and want to join. There were suggestions from that France 24 journalist. And, you know, it's a journalist, and it's ad hoc and it's anecdotal, so there's only so much you're going to take on board. But they were suggesting 70% was what the EU were going to require from the UK to be taken seriously.
The one thing that the EU would be worried about, I think they would in general welcome us back, subject to negotiating bits and pieces here and there. But, you know, Brexit's not been a good thing for the EU either. It's hurt them economically, not nearly as much as it's hurt Britain. And losing a member state for the first time in its history, that's not a good thing. So if we wanted to come back, they in general think, yeah, good. It'd be you know, the one country that's ever left comes back with its tail between its legs and say, sorry, that was a bit of a mistake. That would be good for the from the EU's perspective. But what they would be worried about would be if 10 years down the road, the whole saga starts again. So they'd want it to be clear that it's a genuine change of heart by Britain that's not going to be reversed with a change of government a few years down the line. And for that, I think it would need either, as you were suggesting, a referendum with a very clear majority. I don't think anybody's going to fix a particular figure, but a majority that nobody would challenge for many, many years, not the very narrow results we had in 2016, but something more like 60, 70 would be even better percent. Or you get bipartisan support if the Conservatives change their mind as well, and you had Labour and the Conservatives and Lib Dems all saying, yeah, we're better off inside, so it looks would look rather unlikely that things would change. Things like that, they would need reassuring, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a level of mistrust that's been put in place. It's interesting, though, that the UK doesn't want to touch the Russian interference stuff as much as Moldova quite clearly expressly said it. But as you said, it was more flagrant out there. I mean, the BBC caught a Moldovan lady coming up to the pollsters and asking where she could get paid.
Yeah.
She's just wild. And said, yeah. I think the price was 50 euros and the claims are somewhere between 100,000 and 300,000 people were offered that 50 euro bribe, which doesn't sound like a lot to us, but in Moldova, from what I've understood, that's a substantial amount of money. I don't know what the Moldovan currency is. Madge, what are your thoughts on Moldova? Are you excited and happy for them?
Yeah, it's good. It's good news. I mean, it's kind of annoying for Russia, especially when they've got the breakaway region of Transnistria there as well, that, you know, Russia have got weapons there and things like that. So it's a big blow, I think, for kind of the Russia and misinformation network, but also their bribery network as well, that they couldn't get this one over the line, despite the fact that it was very close. It's good. It's good for Moldova. I think it's good for Europe in general to be out of the kind of Russian sphere. And I think given the fact that Russia, there was a lot of theories that Russia could use Moldova to open a new front in the Ukraine war, it does show you that there is a lot of people in Moldova who are very much anti-Russian, which is a good thing given the fact that Russia invaded one of their neighbors and, you know, shown a lot of aggression to the rest of the world. So I think it's good. It's good for Moldova. I think it's good for Europe, good for Ukraine as well. So it's great news all around. And yeah, Vlad wasted his money once again.
He must have wasted millions on that. But then you're in charge of the country and you can just print off notes, and it wouldn't surprise me if he's got a little printing system.
He's got to get euros in it. So it'd be frustrating because I think the ruble is still quite low. So they would have to do currency exchange, which wouldn't help the ruble that much at all. But I think ultimately, especially given that part of the world where there is a lot of Russian influence in that breakaway region, I think it's great news for Moldova overall, really, that they've seen off more kind of Russian aggression. In that sense, so it's good, you know, to see more countries being more kind of pro EU as well, believing in that kind of project, because it's a twofold thing, really, this one. So we'll see if they can actually make the ascension criteria, because there's still a lot of steps for them to go through. So it's worth keeping an eye on. Yeah, you know, Moldova's
It was quite interesting seeing some of the trolls out on social media questioning as to why Putin would invest in Moldova, and you're like, you don't think he'd want another front opened up against Ukraine around the country? I mean, it's actually wild, but it also says quite a lot about either people being brainwashed on social media to defend Russia, or the complexity in the intelligence of AI being used with the bot systems, because that's quite a complex thing to come out and start questioning. I was surprised at that level, so it made me wonder, am I dealing or seeing someone who's a bot or an actual person making these comments?
It's probably some of them would be bots, some of them wouldn't be. I did speak to someone who is Moldovan, and based on the conversation I had with them, there is a lot of, she said it was quite ironic that Russia used Ukraine to invade part of Moldova, and now there are a lot of Moldovans who fear Russia because of their invasion of Ukraine. So she said that was quite interesting. She said this referendum was incredibly divisive, with like families being split. So some families, their parents might be more pro-Russian, and you know, their kids might be more kind of pro-EU or anti-Russia, that kind of stuff, like families being split real bad. It's kind of like the Brexit referendum, but I think it's a lot worse, because they are on, you know, they're very much near an active war zone, and their country is split as well, to an extent, because of that that kind of independent area, that Transnistria area, which is quite rare for a country to kind of go through where part of it's split off. So, yeah, she seemed quite astonished that I knew about some of the stuff going on in the region. So I do hide the fact that I do politics and stuff at work because it's quite divisive. But it was an interesting conversation. Like, it didn't last long, but it's quite interesting to see, like, kind of there are parallels between that and Brexit. But obviously, I think this one's a lot more real for the people that live there, because the Russian aggression is so, the feeling of Russian aggression is so strong in that region, and the history of that country with having a region split off it. I imagine, like, maybe the younger, I'd have to look at the demographics of it, but I imagine the younger people would be very anti-Russian. Hopefully, anyways.
There's a whole history, of course, because historically Moldova was part of Romania, and they speak Romanian, their language is Romanian. And it was carved off by Stalin to be made part of the Soviet Union, and they gave it an autonomous status, the Moldovan Soviet Republic, but they attached to it Transdniestria to sort of dilute the Romanian character of Moldova. And that's the area which has now split away from Moldova itself. There is talk from time to time in Moldova of reuniting with Romania, which would be a quick back doorway into the European Union, I suppose, like East Germany did when it reunited with West Germany 30 years ago.
Does that mean that we have to reunite with France?
Yeah, well, perhaps the British monarchy can reinstate its claim to be kings of France or something.
Well, I think it'd work the other way around. I think the French would declare Britain a republic. Because there ain't no way. I don't want to learn French.
German royal family, as they say. That was interesting as well last week with Thomas Tuchel. Tuchel? Is it Tuchel?
Tuchel, yeah. Tuchel. Yeah, our royal... The royal family is... largely German ancestry. Yeah, we're European.
That would have, I said it last week, but you would have hoped the newspapers would have been using that as a cause of celebration to show that we've gone past the difficulties and the tensions left over from World War II, and they just added to it. But I mean, it's the Daily Mail. It's what they.
Yeah. Do. Well, the British written press is quite unique in Europe. In its virulent aggressive right-wing attitudes. And after all, if you look at the written media in Britain, the national media, and measure it by readership statistics, over two-thirds are in the hands of just three people, three groups, who all happen to be expatriate tax avoiders, by the way, but they're all on the far right of the political spectrum. And virulently anti-European.
Don't live in the country, do they? Is that a thing?
No, that's my point. They live abroad for tax reasons.
Yeah. Actually, I just saw The Apprentice, the movie, and Rupert Murdoch popped his head in very briefly into that. Have you seen that movie yet?
I've not seen it, no.
Oh, Oscar-winning performances by Sebastian Stan and Jeremy Strong. Absolutely amazing. I mean, I can see why Trump's going to try and sue them, but I mean, that's basic trick. But yeah, Rupert Murdoch happened to pop up in that. So I'd recommend it to all of our listeners. Go and watch that movie, because if it wasn't during the presidential elections, I'm pretty sure everyone in America would be talking about how good that was as a performance, or Trump wasn't running. One of the interesting things you brought up was the numbers. And ITV did a poll in 2022 saying that 86% of youth wanted to come back into the EU, which, I mean, that's game over, isn't it, Richard? That's game, set, and match.
Well, that's one of the remarkable things about how people voted in 2016. If you wanted to know how somebody voted and you could only ask them one single question, you'd ask them how old were they? Because the older you were, the more likely you were to vote Leave. Much more important than gender, region, socioeconomic category, level of education. It was age. And this is not because you become more Eurosceptic as you get older. I'm living proof of that. it's a cohort factor. The era in which you grew up, that sort of thing. And that's one of the reasons why this underlying trend of public opinion saying Brexit was a mistake and even saying we should rejoin continues to grow relentlessly, very slowly but steadily, relentlessly. Most opinion polls are volatile, as you know. They go up and down every month with events. This poll is very steady And the numbers saying, firstly, Brexit was a mistake, and secondly, we should rejoin, continues to go up.
And that includes with the taking the euro and joining the Schengen. That those numbers are going up as well. So originally, those were two stopping points that seemed to be to us being able to rejoin if we had to do that. But it's slowly changing.
Well, yeah, they say those are sticking points. I mean, I don't think we'd have to rejoin Schengen. Ireland isn't in Schengen. Would involve, if we wanted to join Schengen, we'd have to get Ireland to join Schengen, and it would mean rethinking the common travel area with Ireland and a whole load of other things. I think the EU would quite happily accept that we return to the status quo there. The euro, the EU's starting point in the negotiations would be to say, yeah, you should commit to eventually joining the euro one day. But in fact, there are seven EU countries that are not in the euro, that show no sign of joining in most cases in the immediate future. And if you're really about to expand to the Western Balkans and potentially Ukraine, they wouldn't be ready to join the euro for donkey's years. So I don't think when it comes to the crunch, the EU would insist that we join the euro. As you say, there's a good argument for us to do so, but it should be treated as a separate matter.
What do you think, Madge? Do you think that 85% is game, set, and match for the situation?
In the long run.
It's pretty good. If people hold on to those beliefs, but I think it just depends on if we're going to get politicians in that will do it. That's the main problem. And given the system we have in now, I don't think there's a lot of incentive for them to change their views that much for now, because I don't think Brexit will be...
Interestingly, though, the Labour movement for Europe now has more MPs than the Conservative Party.
It's true. The thing is, are they going to push the boat out in order to, because, you know, from what I've read, the UK are kind of being a bit weird on what kind of relationship we want with the EU in terms of it's a lot of just trying to look like they're doing stuff without doing stuff. You know, is there, are we going to do dynamic alignment? What, you know, in terms of the City of London, what are we looking at here? It's not very clear as in what relationship we want with the EU. And I think the issue with the voting system that we have is that I don't think Brexit will be, or being pro-EU will be, the defining factor of anyone's vote. I think most people vote to kind of keep out reform or vote to keep out the Tories. And so I don't imagine for a long time now that people really push Labour to be more pro-EU than they kind of are now. The only ones who could do that, probably the Greens. If we had a lot more Green MPs in, I don't think the way back to the EU will be mostly on Labour. I think we're mostly on Green MPs and people like that to really push Labour into that direction, and the Lib Dems as well, because Labour have got a weird relationship with voters where some of them are kind of anti-immigration. Some of them, there was an interview with one of the kind of, they were talking about the youth mobility scheme, and one of the younger guys that they interviewed, The Guardian, interviewed and said, oh, I don't want this scheme because it's going to increase my immigration. And so that's going to be the big sticking point, I think, again, for people, will be immigration. And so it'll be a long time before I think we join the EU. Because I've said it on this podcast, I've said it on my channel a lot. Immigration is the big problem for certain people in this country. And I feel like until Labour tackle that, until like the people tackle that, that will continue to be a big problem.
And why has this been linked with the EU? Nigel Farage was very skillful in saying, we can't control our borders if we're in the EU and all that nonsense. If you look at the figures, most migration to Britain has always been in recent decades, and even more the case now, by the way, from outside the EU, which is entirely a matter for our own rules. We can be as open or as restrictive as we want. EU migration, as it were, is a reciprocal right, EU freedom of movement. There are plenty of Brits living in other EU countries as well, so it's two-way. And it's not unconditional. It requires a person to either find employment within 3 months or prove that they are self-sufficient, so they are not a burden on the state. Britain never enforced those rules when we were in. That was Britain's fault, not the EU's fault. If you wanted to be tough on this, you could. So EU freedom of movement should not be an issue if you know, even accepting that you should be worried about migration, which is another debate. But if you are, then actually it's not the EU that's the problem.
It's the government. I'll never forget that being brought up with Nigel Farage when he was on LBC. And he insisted there was no mechanism and that he knew everything about it because he worked in Brussels and in Belgium. And literally, I found an article. I can't remember the channel that did it, but they interviewed people who were living in Belgium and saying, if you don't follow the rules that you just stated, Richard, they were being removed. They had 3 months to find work. So you're like, he didn't even know what he was talking about. But as you
I think he knew 100%. I think he knew he was lying. 100% he knew. Because, you know, he was talking about like all of Romania could be here by tea time. It's like, and live where, Nigel? You know, do you think all of Romania are going to migrate over here to live on the street or something like that? Like, are you stupid? But that's the whole point. He made an appeal to emotion and the media were completely just pants. They had no idea how to deal with him. Nick Clegg had no idea how to deal with him. And we had one of the worst campaign groups in the Remain campaign group who were completely ineffective, who didn't realize they had to actually fight back.
There's one way in which Farage's viewpoint has actually shot himself in the foot. Within the EU, there's a rule called the Dublin Regulation, which is that asylum seekers should be processed by the first EU country they arrive in. So Britain could, if it wanted, you don't have to do this. I mean, Germany often doesn't, but you could ask asylum seekers to go back to whichever France or wherever it might have been that they first arrived before crossing the Channel or trying to. You can't do that anymore because you're outside the EU. So if you make a big macho thing about we got to be tough on these boats and all the and others who are coming across, well, hang on a minute. It completely contradicts what you advocated and what you've delivered.
But that's Nigel Farage, isn't it? I mean,
he
defended and said fishing would be better, and he hadn't got a clue when he only turned up to one fishing committee meeting out of, was it 42?
Richard? Yeah. He was on the European Parliament Fisheries Committee at a time when the common fisheries policy was being reformed, some pretty important reforms that mattered, and he only turned up once out of 42 meetings. It's pathetic. But that's what he did in the European Parliament. He used it as a platform back home. He used his office, his assistants, his staff, the facilities, not to weigh in the discussions in the Parliament, but to, as a megaphone back home, to tell people all kinds of nonsense about the European Union, which was usually far from being accurate, shall we say.
Did you? I mean, yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting that he hired his German wife to do work for him, which he said that no British person could do, which was just wild. Yeah. I think that was Nick Robinson who pulled him up on that. What was your... Did you ever meet, clash with Nigel and deal with him?
Many times. No, you couldn't entirely avoid him in the Parliament, but quite often we'd be invited on radio programmes or whatever to debate.
How did you find him?
Very slippery. hard to pin down on, certainly on facts, because if you pointed out that he was wrong on something, he would rather quickly change the subject and move on, drop it, or he'd come up with some alternative reality which he would throw back at you, which was usually far from accurate.
He actually, again, this reminds me of the Apprentice movie that I saw last night, which Trump has three rules, which he gets from a lawyer called Roy Cohen, who was the guy who sent the Rosenbergs, who were supposedly Russian spies in America, to the electric chair. I think evidence has actually shown that they were innocent, and it's two innocent Americans now died.
Yeah, it was during the McCarthy period.
Yeah, but the Roy Cohen apparently told Donald Trump the three rules were attack, 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 deny, 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 and always claim victory. And I'm going, that's Nigel Farage.
Yeah.
It's always attack, it's always deny, and he's always trying to claim some sort of victory in, you know, I mean, he said he'd leave the country if Brexit failed. Is Brexit a success? Like, is there any metric that you can claim Brexit has been a success?
Not really, no. I mean...
Can you name a single benefit?
Farage is on Question Time less. there you go, that's one.
Well... Question Time was part of the problem in the running up to...
It was, I think, the biggest problem, to be honest.
The most popular, the most viewed political programme on television in Britain. And I think in a 10-year period, they had British members of the European Parliament on it about 50 times. Every single time, it was a pro-Brexit or an anti-European MP. Farage the most, but also other UKIP members and Conservatives. But when it was a Conservative, it was always an anti-European like Dan Hannan. They didn't have in that period a single Labour, Lib Dem, Green, SNP or Welsh Nationalist member of the European Parliament.
That's still somewhat reflected today. If you look at the Green Party and how much success they have, it's easily on par with Reform. But how often do you really hear about them being talked about in the mainstream press? Did you know that the head of the I think it's a joint party, joint leader system, isn't it, for the Green Party? I think the female leader of the party, and excuse me for forgetting the name, is it Sian Berry?
Yeah.
Yeah. She was on the front cover of Vogue.
It was, yeah.
She was on the front cover of Vogue. Did you guys know that?
No.
No. But that's actually huge. The only other person, and it's pretty bad to actually make the comparison, the only person I know before that, I think, was it Liz Truss that somehow managed to get into the front cover of Vogue? Which is not a very good accolade. Yeah. But it's just interesting that that's still the case. There's still this ignoring of a party that held its own and got almost as many seats. I think they've got more councillors.
A lot more, yeah.
But
they have grassroots support, yeah.
But then on the flip side, you know, when you look at the youth vote, and also, I mean, this is a point of optimism because we talked about the press a bit earlier. The press is definitely dying out. It's becoming more about social media. And I'm not seeing the press really adapt. You go on their websites, it still looks like something from the 90s, noughties in terms of how the layout and the design is. And it's just covered in sponsorship ads more than it is in actual content. Whereas stuff like we're doing on YouTube and other YouTubers and TikTokers, that's where people are getting their information. Although, scarily, I was at a film premiere the other night.
Director
came up on stage. I'm not going to name drop or anything. I try and avoid that all the time. The director came up on stage, and he's originally from India and moved to the UK at the age of 8, I think it was. And he said that his son was at school and they ran elections. His son's 13. And he said that their school and his son voted for Reform. And it was because of TikTok. Mm. Yeah, I was really... And he had to explain to his son not to do that again. And the reasons as to why and who Nigel Farage is. So as much as I feel like there's this big shift and we can see it with that ITV study from 2022, there's also a bit of concern over social media. What I would hope is that child being 13, when he gets to 16, 18, starts to look further into who Nigel is and starts to see all the other stuff that he's said. That's clearly racist. Mm-hmm. And that's my only hope, but it's also a concern. Any thoughts from you, Richard, on the media and how they've treated yourself in Labour and Brexit?
Yeah, well, you heard from my previous comments that I'm more familiar with the so-called mainstream media and television things like TikTok, I'm somewhat less familiar with, given my age. But yeah, I think you made a valid point. So there's a lot of networks now. In fact, that's perhaps one problem, because even within these networks, like Twitter or whatever, people cluster in groups of like-minded people. They like talking to people that agree with them. They follow people that agree with them broadly. And in the end, you get loads of clusters of people who all agree with each other and perhaps egg each other on in all kinds of directions and are then not confronted with alternative views to their own. It's in a sense, paradoxically, given that the democratic aspects of it, everybody can join in the debate, but in fact it's narrowed the debate into lots of little ghettos, you could say.
What do you think, Madge?
Yeah, I think with Farage, he did manage to get some sort of rehabilitation thing with a lot of the AI Farage stuff on Minecraft. I think that's one of the things that helped him. Yeah, they made some weird AI videos. Yeah, it was really weird. It was him, like, blowing up Starbucks' house or something like that. It was really weird for Minecraft. It's just a game where you, like, build stuff. It's like a sandbox type game where you can basically do what you want. You build, you can farm or whatever and fight monsters, all sorts of nonsense. Something my younger brother enjoyed playing like 10 years ago and he still plays now. But point being is, like, I think that helped him. I think he's got the generation
what
after Z.
What did Nigel Farage do on
Minecraft? Oh, he was like just trolling. He was trolling Starmer. So AI...
He played Minecraft.
No, I don't think it was him. I think it was like an AI thing that they had. And it was him trolling AI Starmer. And it was so weird. And it was hilarious. And I think that helped him kind of appeal to certain people and show that he's cool. mean, there wasn't really him. The other thing is, I know my friend, he lives in the south of England. He was saying like a lot of those kind of younger people, like, you know, 16, 17, they're not going to vote Tory like their parents did. They're going to vote for Reform. And I think that's the concerning block of people, that group after kind of Gen Z, I think, or the back end of Gen Z. They are very different politically, I think. I guess it's like the millennial generation. If you go to the upper end of the millennial generation, some of them are like really pro-Labour or pro-Tory. And if you look at the lower end of millennials, I think they're more like pro-Green, more pro-EU, that group of people. So it depends on like a generation is so large in terms of an age group that is hard to kind of define it sometimes. I think people get lost in that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think that's concerning. You know, like I know a lot of younger people are pro-EU, but I think there will be a cutoff point somewhere where you'll get people who kind of get sucked in again by people like Tommy Robinson and that kind of stuff. The ones whose prospects are much lower than the millennial gen, I guess. Because if you think about like a lot of the people my age and I'll struggle to get a house, imagine in 10 years time, like it's going to be so much worse to try and get on the property ladder, to try and find like a decent job to basically function in society. I think it's going to be a lot harder to do in about 10 years.
I might debate that. I think you've got 3D printing, you've got prehab housing. 3D printing now, you can go up to 3 stories. It's about half the price it would cost to construct. This is a 3-story house. Let's say it's a 2-story house. So it's a 2-story house detached. It's half the price. You need about 5 to 10 workmen. It takes 4 to 6 weeks. And you're going, that's going to change the landscape. But did you also see the Optimus robot that came out from Musk last week? We didn't get a chance to talk about it. Have you seen this, Richard?
No.
So I was talking to my brother about it, who's very tech savvy. And he was like, that was a sales stunt. It literally looks like a robot from iRobot, the movie. You know, hands, legs, able to walk, able to do instructions and move around. And that was generation one. Musk is claiming, but it probably is a sales pitch, that generation two will come out in the next couple of years and you'll be able to purchase it for £10,000. And it'll have an AI function and you'll be able to give it instructions. For £10,000 to have a worker that can essentially work, what, probably 8 to 12 hours a day? After you paid that 10th, I mean, it's slave labor. It's literally going back to the days of Rome. That's the only equivalent I can think of in terms of economics. If you've got that as a workforce available to you and you've got 3D printing, I think housing and the economy is going to change massively in the next 10 years. More and AI. I mean, AI is already changing everything. You know, it's pretty much a personal assistant for free.
Depends if the UK allows those kind of houses to be built as well, and like get buying land. Land is quite expensive. What's it called? Planning permission. That's quite expensive. It's just the whole lot of it. I know Labour are talking about building new towns and whatever, and I welcome that as long as it's, you know, as long as they use up as many brownfields as possible, that'd be best. But I don't think it's going to be any easier, honestly. And then you've got like banks to deal with in terms of borrowing, saving for deposits. There's so much that goes into buying a house. It's incredibly difficult right now.
Electricity connections.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if it's half the price, it's still going, and it takes 4 to 6 months.
Yeah, it will make a difference. Yeah.
4 to 12 months.
Half the price of a house in about 10 years' time would be like 250K. So, trust me. Yeah, it's gonna, you know, it's still gonna cost you a fortune to do that.
I sort of think that's part of the reason why Brexit took place and the vote switched. I think it was media, social media, and I think Russian bots all saying austerity. You know, they were basically saying austerity is not the problem, the EU is the problem. It was almost like the EU's caused austerity, whereas in fact it was the Conservative government and no one really wanted to pin the blame on them. I mean, Cameron is the one that implemented it and then demanded an EU vote, but had clearly no idea what was going on in the background, where there was continual feeding of information that the austerity that people didn't like and didn't want was the fault of the EU and not the Cameron government. I mean, the British public voted in for more austerity that they hated. That's how good the campaigning was. So you sort of look at that and you go, is that going to be something that changes people's minds? Because I could see that with social media, with AI, with Russian interference, with the right, and let's face it, Reform are doing very well with their social media. That is a point of concern when it comes to the next referendum vote. And Reform's surge in the polls. I mean, what do they claim? I think 1 billion interactions on social media, which is like 3 times as much as the Labour Party, which is just clearly nonsense. That's way too many people. It was obviously like some sort of surge with Russian interaction and then bots.
Yeah, because it's several times the population of the UK.
It's not like people in France are aware of who they are.
But going back to this theme of austerity and and going back to what we were saying earlier about what will change the dial on reversing Brexit or at least rejoining the single market and customs union, the pressure on the government with its ambitions of what it wants to do on for the NHS, for housing, for all kinds of things, and to rekindle economic growth in Britain, you won't be able to do that if you keep these barriers to our main trading partners, both vital for export and for our supply chains. It's the rest of Europe. And if you set up a customs border so that every good entering Europe or coming from Europe has to be checked under WTO rules for rules of origin, form filling, checks, etc., it's an extra cost. If you diverge on your rules on product safety, on labelling and conformity testing and so on, then you've got a regulatory border as well, where products are verified to see whether they are safe according to your own rules, because they're different rules from now on. Those two factors are a huge burden for small businesses, especially. Big companies can often cope with them better because they've got the resources. But that's why our trade with the rest of Europe is stagnating. And that's one of the reasons why the OBR says we've lost up to 5% of GDP because of Brexit. Now, for the government and its ambitions, it's therefore really got to revisit these overly cautious red lines of not rejoining the customs union and the single market. If you really want to drive economic growth, that's the pressure on them. The other side of the equation is that the fear of a public reaction, that is still gradually receding because more and more people think that Brexit was a mistake. So it should be less risky for them to move on this as an incentive, and there's less reason to be fearful. So within the Labour Party, and as you mentioned before, the pressure from Greens, Lib Dems, and I would add SNP and Plaid Cymru from outside the Labour Party and from businesses and trade unions perhaps as well, all that will nudge the government to being less cautious about this than it is.
Do you think it's right that it feels like Starmer's trying to walk on a tightrope and he's doing a very tough balancing act because whatever he does, he gets slammed for it. Do you think that's a fair assessment? Do you think that's the way forward for Labour?
He's being cautious on everything, actually. And there's reasons for that. You can see why that happened, why, looking ahead to this election, we're looking back at it now, but if you were Starmer, just become leader of the Labour Party just 4 years ago, just over 4 years ago, looking at the state of play at that point and thinking, what chance do we have of winning the next election? He was building up a position on all kinds of issues where he didn't really want to take risks. Even if when the Conservatives went into meltdown, he didn't want to take the risk that the right-wing media that we have would be able to tear Labour to shreds on this or that. So being very cautious. And having been cautious and put it in the manifesto, you can't suddenly go and do something completely different. You know, that would be bad for politics. But if you're looking at the medium term and a possible second term for Labour, then you've got to start to think ahead about what the country needs. And if you've accepted, as he does, that we really need to get economic growth to restore the state of public finances so that we can more easily afford investment in infrastructure and the future, rebuilding the NHS, addressing the housing issue, and so on and so forth, you've got to start moving on these issues and moving back towards a closer economic relationship with Europe. It's good that he's ambitious on a security agreement with Europe and various other things, research programs and what have you, but they won't change the dial economically.
I can't see what he's put in his manifesto that will make any difference to the economy other than slight tweaks here and there.
He is proposing to realign with single market rules to get rid of all the paperwork and bureaucracy and red tape at the border on phytosanitary, you know, the whole agricultural sector for a start, and I think on chemicals and other things. So if you go down that road sector by sector of a green common rule book with the EU, then you can start to attenuate some of the damage. And if at least they make a start and build up trust and a good relationship with the EU, then perhaps the next stage can be to go a little bit further.
Do you feel as if that's the type of route that you would have considered yourself? Because I get the impression from your time when you were an MEP, it was about lots and lots of collaboration. I think you were very, based on your record, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were very successful at that. And that's why you got more and more embedded into the system. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's Starmer's approach. But I'm also aware, I think all of us play football. I think are into our football to a certain extent. I'm a huge Nigel Clough fan, and a couple of others are big managers. And it's all about taking risks. Like Sir Alex Ferguson, it was all about taking risks. You've got to take those risks. And I think one of the interesting things, I made a comparison. I did a video where I compared Starmer with FDR and Tony Blair. And I felt that a lot of what he did this time round was just a little bit of a step forward from what Tony Blair did. So we could look at workers' rights, we could look at renters' rights, we could look at reforming of the Lords. And these are all little things that Blair did in different ways and in similar ways. And I sort of then looked at what FDR did. And you can debate about the level of power that a president has versus, you know, a prime minister. But you can also say similar big issues that they're having to deal with. FDR had the Great Depression, he had isolationism, he had prohibition. So there were some parallels there as well. And I felt that Blair and FDR did better at taking risks, but I also felt in part they were able to do that because their comms was better. And I don't think Starmer's comms have been as good as they should have been. And that's part of the reason why he's been hindered. And that's why he's having to hold back a little bit on his risk taking, because he's not worked on that area. Like Blair was very good at it. FDR was exceptionally good at it with the technology he had available. And for example, like I get my YouTube channel gets better numbers than Labour's. That shouldn't be the case. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense. I'm not that big on YouTube compared to some of the heavyweights. And you're going, that doesn't make any sense. You're the prime minister. You could go on YouTube once a week, do a short speech, 15 minutes, talk to the camera about what you've done or what you intend to do and why you intend to do it and really get some engagement. But he doesn't do that. And I then go, you become your own limiting factor to such an extent. You're now having to rely on something that's dying out, or you have to listen to something that's dying out instead of taking the lead and taking advantage of the technology. Would that sound fair? Because I see, Richard, you want to jump in.
Well, when you started off and you said, compared to football managers, you have to take a risk to win. My immediate reaction was saying, well, you know, if you take a risk and you don't pull it off as a football manager, what happens? You lose a game or you don't win a trophy. If you take a risk with a country and its economy and it goes wrong, you've fucked up the whole country. So I thought, ooh, wait. But what you then went on to, I think, was saying, should he take more of a risk in his communications and explaining what he's doing and getting the message across? And I should imagine he's up for that. The problem we have is the media landscape, what we were talking about before, an overwhelmingly hostile press, which often will simply not report good news and will just leap on anything that, and however trivial, that they can attack you on. That's one of the limiting factors in this country, more than in any other European country that I know.
I then think he's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. So just fuck the press and just create your own cons. I mean, so it was interesting that Trump didn't take on that second debate with Kamala Harris. He's not daft. He realized he lost. That's why he won't have another one, because she'll tear him to shreds again. So it's like, instead of going and attacking that strong point, you go for a different direction. And what Trump's actually done is one of the things I would have suggested. So he's hitting all the podcasts, all the massive ones, and the ones that aren't related to politics. So I think he's just done one with The Undertaker from the WWE. What the hell does that guy know about politics? But his following is huge, and he's actually hit that base. Sadiq Khan.
He's reaching out beyond the usual suspects, beyond people who would automatically tune into a political show. Yeah.
But so did Sadiq Khan. So Sadiq Khan went to Politics Joe, which is half a million subscribers. Why isn't Starmer going on there? I don't. But Sadiq Khan was savvy enough to realize actually that's a great place. I mean, they're very London centric as well. Politics Joe. They go around the globe, the UK and part of the globe, but they're very London centric. So I'm sort of again go, and then I think Trump's meant to be going on Joe Rogan, who said that he wouldn't have him, and that's the biggest podcaster. He said he wouldn't have him. Somehow they've twisted an interview. I don't know how that's going to pan out, but that's actually quite concerning, because if Joe Rogan goes soft on him, which I hope he doesn't, then that could be a huge game changer. But it'll also show the power of podcasts compared to mainstream media. So again, I'm just going, Starmer could have done that. And I think when I say risks, I mean, obviously football, it's about scoring a goal. And if you try and push too much, you can then also concede as a result. With this, I mean, even 3D printing, I would have put that forward if I was Starmer. That's such a no-brainer. It would have upset the building industry. But so what? We need more houses. And it would have been popular if you pointed out to people that the price of housing was halved.
At Labour Party conference outside the front entrance was not 3D housing, but modular housing.
That's another one.
Used to be called prefab, but now it's much more modern and doable and looks a lot nicer. And there was one of those as an illustration of what can be done much more quickly than before. So that's a good thing. But, you know, did the media pick that up? No.
But then that's the interesting thing in going in a different direction. Maj, what are your thoughts?
I think their comms team, we spoke about this for over a year, it's a couple of years, their comms team is awful. And I think if they did put out more broadcasts, like you said, on YouTube, they control what's being said, they control the narrative. So they can actually talk about whatever it is they want to talk about rather than getting dragged into issues that they're either bad with or struggle to deal with. And of course, you can always edit things out as well. So it doesn't have to be live. You can do pre-recorded stuff. Like I think Wes Streeting kind of fumbled when he was talking about weight loss drugs, and you know that story's come out about Labour using weight loss drugs on overweight unemployed people, and you're just like, what is this? What is going on here?
I've got to defend him there and say he did do really well afterwards, because he did come out and say, I wasn't advocating to go around with a needle
and
people randomly.
Yeah, I saw that. I did see that. I did cover it in the full video. The issue is that, like, once kind of stories come out like that, like, you lose the control over the narrative completely. And that story did get worse, because you had the CEO of Eli Lilly talking about how the UK needs to be an interesting place to invest in, and Eli Lilly have invested more in the UK. And then you find out they make one of these weight loss drugs, and you're just like, what's this? What's going on? So I think Labour need to be better at controlling the narrative. And I don't think that they have the comms team who are prepared to be able to put out stories. You know, they don't have Alistair Campbell anymore. They don't have someone who understands the media that well. They've got the worst, you know, budget Dominic Cummings, who didn't understand the media much in the end. And that's one of the things that was his undoing in Morgan McSweeney. I don't think he's as savvy as people make him out to be. I mean, the whole situation with Sue Gray, like, that was really, really just disgusting. The way they kind of tore her down in the press, and they kept putting out stories about how they expect her to resign by conference. And you're just like, what is this? And this is what I'm saying. Like, they need to figure out who's leaking information, but also they need to figure out what kind of people do they want in the comms team. Do you want people that are aggressive and push stories out when Labour need them? Or what's going on with that? And it's been a joke for a couple of years now.
You're suggesting they should bring back Alistair Campbell?
If it were me, and I say this every time, you know, the Iraq dossier aside, and all of the stuff that happened around the Iraq war, right, they should 100% have that man as an advisor. Because I'm telling you, I saw one of the clips, I've covered it in a video, that come out where he was talking about Labour's problems, that how they need to be, not whiter than white, but they need to be more careful about the stuff they're doing, like around the freebies or the bribes, however you want to define it, things like that. Where if he saw stuff like that going on, he'd be like, what are you doing? Or he would have gone on the offense and attacked the Tories, saying about the wallpaper and stuff. Is like, you were never there when Boris Johnson was doing this stuff. But the problem is, once you go into that, you kind of do push the idea of you're all kind of the same. So, oh, we took money, but we declared it. He didn't. He took money, but didn't declare it. And the public just see you both took money.
Yeah.
And Campbell kind of gets that, I think. So, you know, as much as I dislike the guy and I dislike Rory Stewart, his podcast partner, they suck. We're a lot better than them, in my opinion. You know, I'll say that straight up, you know. Yeah, I say that straight up. But Alistair Campbell is a guy who understands the media. Morgan McSweeney, he's a data nerd. That's what he is. He looks at numbers. He does aggressive triangulation. And I don't think he understands the media that much at all. You know, when I watched that show, Thick of It, you know, the one with Peter Capaldi, There's an episode where some young journalist is going to put out a story that's incredibly damaging the government. He says, cool, put the story out. We're going to make sure no one hires you. No one, no press outlet's going to cover you, because if we see you there, we're not going to talk with them. And that's incredibly bullying, which Morgan McSweeney did to the Canary, but I don't think he's that savvy in order to deal with that kind of stuff. I don't want to see people bully members of the press, but it does show you that Campbell is quite smart in what he does. I think he understands the media again. And I think that's what they need. They need someone to go in there and be a good comms team and understand that when a story comes out, how are the media going to play it? Because it's very obvious the way most media people play stories out, like Kay Burley, Laura Koonsberg, all of those kind of people. They try and question you aggressively with some of the dumbest follow-up questions I've ever heard in my life on occasion. And I'm just like, what is this? What are you talking about? Right. And then you need to be able to prepare ministers who, some of them aren't that bright. I'm not going to name names this time around, but I've done videos on them. They're not that bright. You know, they talk about EU doctors and nurses taking jobs from their constituents, and then has to say, well, you know, we never had the medical places anyways to, you know, train up our own in my constituency. And I'm like, yes, you genius. They didn't take jobs from your constituents. They actually filled vacancies we needed. Yeah, my audience know, the people know who I'm talking about here. But when you give answers like that, you look stupid, because these debunk. And one of the things they have is, I think, a lot of ministers who aren't very good in interviews and aren't very bright. So you need to have a comms team that will brief them aggressively and say, look, this is the line. You're going to push this line, but make sure that's actually intelligent. You know, the line of, oh, so what? He took the freebies. At least he declared it. And then it comes back to Starmer saying, oh, I'm not going to take any more suits. And you're like, you're Boris Johnson 2.0, lad. You can't do it. You know, you've got to decide at that point. You've got to decide. No, because that's what Boris Johnson did. That's what Boris Johnson did. Boris Johnson would get involved in a scandal and it would play out really badly, right? And then what happens is, in the end, he goes, oh, yeah, I know that was bad, guys. Oh, I'm not going to do that again. And then at some point later on, he'll do it again, right? When the media kind of, the heat dies down. But he made all of these ministers go out to bat for him, right? On a policy or a scandal that was really bad. Right. And all these ministers look stupid because they all get involved in this to defend him. And then he pulls back, you know, with the freebie stuff. That's exactly what we saw. All the ministers coming out and saying, well, it wasn't that bad. You know, at least he declared it. Oh, it was only, you know, a few thousand here and there, whatever. And then he then Starmer goes, oh, I'm not going to take any more free clothes or glasses from Lord Alley. And you're like, that's all you had to say in the first place. Just come out and say, yeah, you know, whatever, we were wrong for doing that. Or, you know, this is the kind of thing the British public doesn't like. I get it. We're going to change the rules so we can't do this. No one can do this in the future. That's all he had to come out and say, literally day two of scandal. But instead, it dragged out for 3 weeks. And then he comes out and says, oh, you know, I paid some of the money back, but not all of it. And you're like, what? Like,
this is the antithesis of the advice given to Donald Trump. Attack, yeah, and deny and claim victory.
Do you know the thing is, though, Donald Trump, he's funny and he's energetic, and that's the difference. Starmer is not, he's not funny, he's not energetic, and I feel like if he tries that kind of attack line, it will fall flat because he can't do it, because he argues like a lawyer. He's boring. And Trump is funny, he's got memes, he's a joke. You know, like the guy used to tweet when he was president at 3 a.m. about absolute nonsense and get into disputes with people. You know, the funniest Trump tweet I've seen is the Nickelback song where, you know, it says, look at this photograph, right? And it's a quote with Joe Biden saying, I've never met that man in my life, right? Some Ukrainian dude who gave his son a job, right? And in the picture, you can literally see Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, his son, and that dude in the picture. And the song goes, look at this photograph. And I was like, that's funny. That's funny. I looked at that and that was about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whatever long it was. No, it was longer, actually, because when he was president, about 6 or 7. That's funny because he can do that. He understands how people work. Whereas with Starmer, like, you have to be a clean cut dude because you can't handle aggressive questioning in the media. You have to be a lot better because you can't involve yourselves in so many scandals because the media are going to tag you aggressively, which they love doing. And if you're not good at combating the media, just stay out of dumb stuff. Just focus on policy, sure. Focus on how you're going to help people and leave it at that. You give the media nothing. You know, what are they going to talk about with these stories? You're going to increase our debt to GDP ratio for investment. And you're like, yeah, I'm going to increase the amount of debt. We're going to borrow more money to invest in the public rather than giving that money to Dido Harding or some random dude to buy PPE. We're actually going to give that money to help with public services because that's what the British public want, better public services. And then the media have nothing because you've given them barely any scandals. Instead, you've got them talking endlessly about Taylor Swift tickets. And you're like, what is this?
No, I was just saying, so to sum up what you're saying, you think Starmer's a bit too straight-laced rather than being a good showman?
I think it's partly that. I think, you know, the one thing I learned about certain types of English football fans, I think they love a good tackle, a big tackle, theatrics. They love someone who tries hard and runs around a lot rather than someone who's very good technically on the ball. They don't like that.
Ronaldinho versus Roy Keane.
I'm telling you, It's not just techno. He's clowning people. I'm talking about like Xabi Alonso or someone like that. That we don't value people like that who are like very good at, you know, moving things forward. But what I will say is, I think he either needs to be more, not he doesn't need to be more kind of charismatic or anything like that, because I think people see through that. It's just, don't involve your stuff in dumb scandals if you know you can't get out of it. With Boris Johnson, like, he's a clown. He makes people laugh and people don't take him seriously. With Starmer, I think people do take him seriously by the way he dresses and the way he speaks. And so if you get involved in weird and stupid scandals or things that the media make into scandals, you can't get out of it as easily as they can.
Go on, Richard. What were you going to say to that? Or was there, because something's popped into my head that he could do with the infrastructure program, but he's not.
No, I made my point that his strength in one way is that he's serious, he's straight-laced, he's not a clown. But because he's not a showman, he loses out in some quarters. That's true. So I'm not disputing what you're saying, but there is an advantage as well of having somebody who is serious, plays by the rules, etc. After what we've had over the last few years, that's an improvement. But yeah, I take your point that in getting messages across, that can pose problems.
I just remembered, like, when FDR did the New Deal, there was a huge poster campaign that came out at that time using Art Deco images, which was obviously the style at the time, mm-hmm. to sort of emphasize this big new plan that they're doing and how they're going to advertise that. Again, I'm going, why aren't they doing that? You could have those posters put out on social media and just doing the rounds saying, look at this. I mean, I wouldn't call it the New Deal because that's overused as a term and Americanized, associated with America. But you could have something, you know, the great infrastructure project, the great rebuild of Britain. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
And then have a poster campaign to go out with it to sort of advertise and grab people's attention. And I think FDR was quite straight-laced. He was a very good speaker. There's no two ways about it. You know, you don't win several presidency runs, in fact, illegally, because you're only meant to run two, but that was convention.
That the constitutional amendment was brought in after him.
He kept winning. He won so much, they changed the rules and said, no, we're not having him do it again.
Yeah.
Everyone gets to.
But nonetheless, I mean, you know, he must have been doing something right, but I never got the impression from his speeches that he was considered Mr. Charisma. But it was interesting. I think the other thing is, there's two things. Did you see the Rest Is Politics clip? I think they were in Birmingham. Were they in the NAC this week doing a live Rest Is Politics? And they had Rest Is Politics US. It was crammed. I haven't seen that like in the UK, where the entire NEC was completely filled with people just to see those guys talk. So I was quite taken back. They obviously hit a chord with politics in the UK. The other thing I'm going to ask as a quick question, which footballer would you have? So Tony Blair did describe Alistair Campbell as a footballer in his team. Who would you sort of associate Alistair Campbell with? Do you have any idea who it might have been?
As a footballer to compare Alistair Campbell to?
Yeah, so Tony Blair said, you are my blah, blah.
Virgil van Dijk?
It's too modern, isn't it? It's too modern.
Magic ideas.
Defending, rescuing the team from difficult situations, and then relaunching.
You're very close with that, actually.
So it's sort of been, I'm trying to think which footballers it could have been. Could it be early 2000? It wouldn't be Pirlo. Pirlo's too early for that as well. You got a nationality. Can you be a nationality? Can't get a clue.
No, I'll have a little bit, but not too much. UK.
Is it Paul Scholes? No.
No, but close. You're both quite close. Roy Keane. Tony Blair.
Ah, see, he got two mentions in this podcast. That's how much we love Roy Keane.
Well, we love Keane, right?
Well, he's an enforcer. He's very good technically, but he was an enforcer as well, and he kept people in line. And dude's a mean guy.
I'm sorry to say, we're out. The timer says no more. The lamp says goodbye. I'd like to say a big thank you for Richard for coming on. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed that.
Yes, very interesting discussion.
Social media. I'll put a link in the description for Richard's social media accounts. Madge's links are also in the description, as well as my own, for our own channels. Thank you so much. If you enjoyed this and you want the channel to grow a little bit more, hit that like and subscribe button. Once again, everyone, thank you very much. Hail to the lamp. Bye.
Bye-bye.
in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.